Okay. All right, so good evening. Thanks, everyone, for coming. I put at the top some of the questions that were sent to answer up from last time. So hopefully we'll have a chance to answer all these questions. However, just a disclaimer, it's not so simple to answer all these questions. There's going to be a lot of background in order to try to have a complete and comprehensive answer. Just to give like an off-the-cuff, it wouldn't do justice to the question, it wouldn't be fair to you. So the questions we'll try to get on: how have we evolved since the Torah was written? What are loopholes, adaptations? Who and what constitutes making halachic decisions? What are the... Sorry.
Is the door unlocked?
No, there is... unfortunately, the world we live in, the door is locked. We have a code.
Can I put something there, or is that a problem?
It should be the end of the door. You want to put a chair in the door or something like that?
Just because we do know other people who
okay,
are
yeah,
coming.
Okay, yeah. Fine,
sorry,
sure. Okay.
Go out again in 5 minutes and close it.
Okay, where are we holding? Who and what constitutes making halachic decisions? What are the boundaries of rabbinic laws? What are heterim allowed? And then, I guess, trying to trace the starting with the giving of the Torah to modern day today.
What's the teretz? Yeah.
Oh, heter. Okay, so in halacha, there's things that are permitted. That's called mutar. Literally, the word means mutar, means it's unbound. It's not tied to anything. Hi, good evening. It's not tied down to anything. It's permitted to be used. So if mutar is something, it's permitted. So heterim are when person has is permitted to do something. So, let me think off the cuff of an example. Something that might not be allowed for everybody, but certain times there are what we call heterim, lenient rulings given, just knowing a person's circumstances. It's always important that when choosing a rabbi, it has to be somebody who, first of all, is qualified. That can't be understated. It's not everybody who, ouch, it shouldn't be recorded, but not everybody who uses the name rabbi is qualified to issue rulings in terms of Jewish law, in terms of halacha. But in addition to just being knowledgeable, they have to know you personally, because two different people could ask the exact same question. Two different people ask the exact same question and they'll get different answers, depending on the background, depending on where they're at in their spiritual journey. So it's always important to have somebody who knows you and where you're coming from. That's why sometimes you need to just get an answer from somebody, but it's always best to ask with a Rav, someone who knows you and your life situation and can give you an appropriate psak. So certain times when there are heterim allowed, we'll try to get to that through the course. Please, yeah. Yeah, it's a leniency, correct. It is a leniency. If I use any words that are unclear, please feel free to ask. This is we're Hamish around here. Do you know what Hamish means? Okay, all right, good. Yeah, oh yeah, they're all up front, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Apologize, okay. So we're just starting now. The first source where everything really begins from is the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, which traces the development of Jewish law. And we understand, how many Torahs did we get at Har Sinai? How many Torahs did we get? One or two. I thought one also. It's two. The answer is two. So let's break this down and understand where it is. It's a bad joke. Moshe said, how much does the Torah cost? They're free. Okay, so I'll take two. It's a bad joke. The real answer is that there's two Torahs. There's the written Torah, which what we call is Chumash, the five books of the Torah. Bereishis in English is Genesis. There's Shmos, the book of Exodus, the book of Leviticus, the book of Numbers, the book of Deuteronomy. So those are the five books of the Chumash. It's written, not never to be changed. At the same time that Moshe got the what's called the written Torah, he also got the oral Torah. And they're indispensable. They came down together, intertwined. It is impossible to understand correctly the written Torah without having the guide of the oral Torah that went down simultaneously, generation by generation. Let me give you a quick example or two of how it would be impossible to understand it, to take the Torah literally. The Torah says when you place the tefillin, you place them bein einecha. You know what the words bein einecha literally means? Between your eyes. So that would mean, if I took the Torah literally, I would place my tefillin right here in between my eyes. It's ridiculous. If a person puts their tefillin right there, they did not get the mitzvah at all. What it means, bein einecha, means in that space between there, but it has to be higher up on the head. I'll give you another example where if you took the Torah, the written Torah, without the oral tradition, you would not get it right at all. Famous example that the Gemara gives is for Sukkos. So do you know how the fruit, the esrog, is described in the Torah? There's three words it used called a pre-eitz hadar. Pre is a fruit. Eitz of the tree. Hadar is beautiful. So when the Torah tells me, what should I take and wave with my lulav? I should take a beautiful fruit. Could be a pear. I'm more colorful than you. I take a mango. Get some wild guy coming to shul with a pineapple. Right? Someone's wearing a starfish. This is my fruit. Right? You want to talk about those little...
Carambola.
There you go. Let's have a contest. Who can be as creative as they can? The answer is, sorry, that's not the mitzvah. The only... And again, I only know that from the oral Torah, which was given to Moshe at the same time. When he came down, the way it worked was like this. In a nutshell, he came down and he says, look, I'm teaching you a halacha now. And he'd read the pasuk and he'd tell us what it means. And he explained, and by the way, these are the laws that accompany that. When we learned about on Sukkot, what you're supposed to do to take a pre-Eitz Hadar, he said, and the correct interpretation of this is an Esrog. And even, let's go back to Tefillin for a second. If you look at the actual verses where it's described it, there's certain things that Tefillin have to have that are nowhere written in the Torah. The fact they have to be black. Hey, I'm colorful. I like pink. If you get pink tefillin, I'm going to throw you out of shul. It's not the mitzvah. They have to be completely square. If they are rounded, tefillin no good. It doesn't say anywhere what's supposed to be written in there. And there's a difference between the arm tefillin and the head tefillin, as whether it's they're all written in one parchment together, but in four separate parchments. So we have many, many intricate halachos, which are nowhere in the Torah. It's all part of the oral tradition. I wasn't going to plan to do this, but let's jump to the last page for 1 second. I'll show you there's a category the Rambam gives on this of the two Torahs. The five categories of the Rambam, Maimonides tells us about the two Torahs, the oral Torah and the written Torah. Number one, Perushim Hamukablim Mipi Moshe Rabbeinu. This is how to correctly understand what the words mean in the Torah. There's a second category of Halachos LaMoshe Mesinai, certain things that were taught to Moshe. Here's an interesting one. I say I heard a knock. Where does it come from the idea that a bar mitzvah becomes 13? Signs of maturity. Okay.
Right.
So the how do we know... hello, Andrea. Welcome.
Hello.
How do we know how old it is? Some people might be 10, some might be 20, some might be 15. We don't know. So the oral tradition, these are all things that are given over the shiur, and the amounts for certain things are given halach l'moshe m'sinai. Number three, the midos, shator nidresh ben. There are certain things, that's why it's great to learn Hebrew, just so you can understand how the Torah is written. There are certain nuances that cannot be accurately captured in a translation. When the Torah uses words for certain things, it's very specific. And if you have an oral tradition that was given, that goes all the way back to Har Sinai, when a word is used, the same word is used multiple places, you can learn halachos, Jewish law, from one case to another case, because that exact same word is used. In a translation, it might not come across, but in the Hebrew original sources, that would come across. And there's two more things which we're going to get to in right now. Gezeros, which are restrictions, and the tekanos are actual mitzvahs to do. So I'll refer back to these as we go through things. This, I just probably should put that in the front, but here we go. The first thing is the chain of transmission. Moshe kibbutz Torah miSinai. Moshe received on Har Sinai. Mostly Yeshua gave Yeshua, Yehoshua the Zakenim. He gave the elders, the came Nevi'im, he gave the prophets, Nevi'im, Mosul, the Anshe Knesset Gedola. I have, for your viewing pleasure, on the next page, a chart. The 40 generations from Moshe getting the Torah at Har Sinai, all the way down till when the Talmud, which is the Torah, the Oral Torah, the Torah Shebaal Peh, it's called, the Oral Torah was, so to speak, compiled and sealed. In the term that's called Chasimas HaTalmud, it means it was over that period where it was fixed. So if you look and you count, some of these names on the list would sound pretty familiar to you. If you see Moshe Rabbeinu, you see Yoshua, in English is Joshua, we see Shmuel, we see David HaMelech, King David, we see Elijah the prophet is on here, that's Eliyahu. Famous rabbis, that's the prophet section, the men of the great assembly, the Tanoim are the rabbis who authored the Mishnah, a very important thing. Work in Jewish law, and the Amoraim are the rabbis who discussed the rulings that were contained in the Mishnah. So, what's the last name on the list? Rav Ashi. We're going to pick it up with Rav Ashi and see where that takes us. Before you know it, here's 40 generations or so. I was on a Shabbaton earlier this year in Passaic. I had the privilege of teaching at a girls' high school called Na'aleh. And for an activity that they did, it was like Shabbos morning before the after Kiddush, before the meal. So every girl walked into the room and they handed them a piece of paper. 80, maybe 100 girls, I don't know exactly how many were there. And everyone got on their sheet a piece of paper and it said, my name is Rabbi So-and-so, I'm a student of Rabbi So-and-so. And it's like it was based on this list. It looked on this list, so they would have Amos And then they would say, well, I'm a student, Yeshayahu. And they would have to find, it was a game, it was like an icebreaker. All the girls had to go around running around, you know how teenagers are, they're running around trying to find, oh, I found my brother! I'm so happy they found, I'm Rashi, I'm Rabbeinu Tam, okay, Mazel Tov. So we made a whole long thing, and by the end, when all the dust settled, so it was how big it was going to be, they made like a huge thing, took up the whole room, the whole ballroom was there, and one girl said, I'm Moses. I got the Torah. And the girl next to her said, my name is Yoshua, and I got the Torah from him. And went all the way around the room. They went through the Middle Ages. They went through all the way down. And the girls were like seeing. And like they got excited because like if a name came up, like we mentioned in class, like, oh, we actually learned about him, right? And then they went all the way down. So I'm going to fast forward 70, 80 girls, blah, 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 goes around. And they got to the Vilna Gaon. And they said, the Vilna Gaon had a student. The next one, I'm Reb Chaim Volozhiner. Said, and I'm a student of Chaim Volozhiner, and I'm a student of the Netziv. And then the Netziv went to the Beis Halevi, and the Beis Halevi went to Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik went to Reb Soloveitchik. And when it got to Reb Soloveitchik, they said from Reb Soloveitchik went to Rabbi Yudin. It's my rabbi in Fairlawn. He was a student of Rabbi Soloveitchik at Yeshiva University. And then I was the lucky person in the whole room. I was the only one who actually got to play myself, right? I'm Rabbi Jaffe, and I received the Torah from Rabbi Yudin. And they had a girl stand next to me and say, my name is so-and-so, and I received the Torah from Rabbi Jaffe. Like, oh wow, we made it, we completed the circle, we had all again. But it was such a beautiful exercise because the girls really understood the Mesorah and how there is a transmission to it. And everything we talk about and all the mitzvahs we do and everything that we do has a place that's the word for tonight, Mesorah, our tradition. And it's not only laws, there are attitudes of the Mesorah as well. There are things that were passed down from rabbi to student throughout the generations it's the essence of Judaism. So let's pick it up. The last name on this list of the Amoraim is Rav Ashi. So in source number 3, I apologize, I tried to translate most things on here in the sheet, but this one I didn't get to. Rav Ashi Omar takes a pasuk, a verse that says, "Shmartim es mishmarti." You should guard my laws. So that's what the Torah says. So Rav Ashi explains, "Asu mishmeres l'mishmarti." You should make a guard, a fence for mine. So I googled and found this cute little picture of a nice white picket fence. You have a rose garden. And this rose garden, you don't want it to get trampled on. When you have something that's so precious and so special, you put up a fence so that it shouldn't get misused. Our Torah is so special, we have to put up certain fences and restrictions to make sure it doesn't get abused, misinterpreted. And therefore the rabbis are told, he's quoting a verse in the Torah which tells us, Hashem says, God says, I want you to make safeguards. I don't want it to be open and exposed. I want there to be certain boundaries and restrictions and additional things which are not necessarily required by the letter of the law, but I'm empowering the rabbis and encouraging the rabbis to set up certain things like this, which we'll get to now in a second. Okay, now you turn to the next great picture I googled. The guards at Buckingham Palace. So you tell me, are they protecting the palace or are they just showing the significance of whoever lives there? What's the role of these guards at Buckingham Palace? With their notice that's like a rifle from the 1700s.
When I was 7, I tried to get a ladder.
Did you get to laugh?
No,
those guys are pretty. They're very serious. The Buckingham Palace guards are very stark. You know, you can't get them. So what's the answer? Why are they there?
Symbolic.
Are they real? Come on, they're going to stop. You know, God forbid a terrorist wants to get through. No. Terrorists with a semi-automatic gun. These guys with like rifles. No contest. You know, when I was a kid. I remember going to a museum. I forget what fancy schmancy painting it was, but it had a little velvet rope. Like you couldn't get so close to it. Now, I was a kid, so I tried to jump the rope. And the guard came quickly and pointed out, the rope's there for a reason, kid. You can't jump the velvet rope wasn't there to hold me back. I jumped it. But the point was to show, don't come too close. Respect, have a little bit of awe and reverence for this masterpiece of artwork. So the guards are there not set for protection, it's there to show something. So many times that there are fences that are made to show the significance of what it is. Not necessarily as a protection, but on the other hand, the rabbis of the Talmud were geniuses and had a phenomenal insight into human nature, and they knew exactly where to make a fence and where not to make a fence. And from our modern day sensibilities, not every case, oh, yeah, come on, you're doing a fence because that might lead to something. I'll give you an example. The halacha is, that if Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos, we don't blow shofar. First day Rosh Hashanah, if it falls out on Shabbos, we'll not blow shofar. Blow the second day. Do you know why they don't blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah? It falls out on Shabbos? We're afraid a person might come and carry the shofar in a place where you're not allowed to carry, Therefore, you're going to violate Shabbos. The laws of Shabbos don't permit one to carry unless there's an enclosed area. So you're going to violate this. So if you told me the reason behind it, I'll say, come on, Rabbi, I'm a smart guy. Friday afternoon, I'll put my shofar right here under the bima. And when it comes time, Shabbos morning, I'll pick it up and I'll blow it. Don't be so smart. Don't be such a chacham. Don't try to circumvent the rules. They knew what the risks were, and they said not to do it. So therefore, we don't. Let me show you. It's actually a pasuk in the Torah. The verse tells us about that we're commanded to listen to rabbinic authority. That it's not just the rabbi said, you know what? I need an ego boost. I'm going to decide to invest ourselves with some power, some authority. The Torah itself mandates that we're required to listen to the rabbis. There is a case of a person. Let's say there was. We have in American law, we have a Supreme Court, right? We're not going to get into the whole impeachment right now. We're just going to talk about the Supreme Court. We're not going to talk about impeachment. We're just going to talk about the Supreme Court. And it's the highest level of law in the land, right? You can't get higher than the Supreme Court. So in Judaism also, we have that called the Sanhedrin. 71 of the greatest scholars, the greatest rabbis of the generation, and they were in Jerusalem, in the base of Migdash. And if anybody had a question in any area of Jewish law, and they didn't know the answer, they would go and travel there. Is this kosher? Is it not kosher? Is this guy guilty or innocent? Is this pure or is this impure? Whatever type of question they would have, they would go travel, then they'd get an answer. They would figure it out, they'd give them a what's called a psak, a ruling. If a person would go back and purposely change the answer, the Sanhedrin, the rabbis told me it's guilty, and I come home and say, no, really, he's innocent. They say it's kosher, and I come back and say it's not kosher. Whether it was being strict or being more lenient, it doesn't matter. The point is they changed it, such a person was executed. Why is it such a strong, harsh death penalty for changing this law? To modern sensibilities, it sounds it's pretty extreme. It's betraying, it's undermining the authority, right? It basically causes the whole system to collapse. If we have a whole tradition from teacher to rabbi, and everything is going with our Masorah, with our traditions and our transmissions of it, if someone comes along and tries to change that and circumvent it as an outsider, it's undermining the entire authority. So we have a central body of things. And again, there's votes, there's debates, there's discussion. It's not just chip chop, let's get on to the next one to give an answer. They debate these issues. And you have certain times, the Gemara tells us there were certain arguments that took years and years and years. Years! 13 years, they argued about a simple point, a single issue. But once the decision was made, the decision was made. Okay, so that verse, it says, I'm going to read it in English in number 11. According to the law they instruct you, and according to the judgment they say to you, you shall do, you shall not divert from the word they tell you, either right or left. Don't divert. You must follow. Now, I want to explain what this means. This does not mean every time any rabbi says something to you, you have to follow, because this is in the Torah. It's talking about a very specific group of bodies. It's talking about that Sanhedrin. It's talking about those 71 rabbis who were empowered and were required to make laws that were incumbent upon every single Jewish person wherever they lived. It was on all of Bnei Yisrael. Every single Jew had to follow that. We didn't have a choice. This was it. If they got up and made a law, we don't carry a shofar on Shabbos, if Rosh Hashanah, we don't do it. There's no ifs, ands, buts about it, done. Once that body ceased to exist, with the destruction of the base of Migdash, of the temple, no one nowadays has the authority to make a rule that's binding upon all of Klal Yisrael. What do you have? The Rambam, Maimani, tells us that instead, every group of rabbis goes and makes laws and rules for their particular community. Yeah.
So that's kind of my question. Does the Gaonim period come after the Sanhedrin? Or
yes, Gaonim is after.
Okay.
Sanhedrin ended with the destruction of the base of Migdash.
Right.
And then after you have the Gemara.
Were basically each kind of community is like almost like a ruling person, right?
Yeah. But for their communities, not right. For you know
right.
the Jews in Poland. You know what I'm saying? Like the outside was not affected by them.
Okay.
They weren't.
So they would then be the ruling people.
That's not the Sanhedrin. That the Gaonim could not make they were very powerful and very influential, but they could not make a ruling that's binding on all the Jewish people.
But, I mean, just like binding on their community.
Correct. On their community was binding.
Okay.
And if you're part of their community, you were bound by it.
Similar to like a base name.
Yeah. Similar. Correct. Is that clear? Any Okay. All right, so let's move things on a little bit. One of the things, we've been talking about the power of the rabbis. The rabbis are so powerful, they can give you mitzvahs also. There are 7 mitzvos that are rabbinic, not from the Torah, the rabbis. Again, the Torah says you have to listen to the rabbis, and even if you think about it, I'll give you 1 of the 7. You'll pick the other 6 out for me. One of the 7, you want an easy one or a hard one?
Hard.
Yeah, easy.
Hard?
I heard easy first, so... Chanukah. Chanukah is not mentioned in the Torah. Chanukah is a rabbinic holiday. And yet, when we had the privilege of lighting the Chanukah menorah, Asher Kiddushon Tzav Vitzivanu, which means, God, you commanded us. L'halik Ner Shel Chanukah. Time out. God, you commanded us to light a menorah? No, you didn't. Who commanded us? The rabbis. The rabbis commanded us. And yet, nevertheless, even though it's a rabbinic thing, we make a bracha, we say, you commanded us, God. How's that happen? The answer is, from that same case we just talked about Sanhedrin, when it tells us that you have to listen to what the rabbis tell you, it's when they tell you to yes, do certain things, and when they tell you to not do certain things. So the same rabbis who come along and say, you can't have, I'm giving you the same example, you can't carry that shofar on Rosh Hashanah that falls out on Shabbos, the same rabbis who tell you, make a bracha, when what? Lighting Chanukah. Purim is the second one. Lighting Shabbos candles on Friday afternoon is from the rabbis. Not mentioned anywhere in the Torah. Making a bracha, I'm about to have my cup of coffee, I make a bracha, shahakol niyeh bidvaro, that's from the rabbis. Hallel is from the rabbis. Washing your hands before bread is from the rabbis. 7 brachas we have from the rabbis. Look in source number 5. Ask the Gemara, this is talking about the context of Chanukah, what blessing does he recite? My mevarich, asher kidshan mitzvasav, vitzivanu, who he recites, who made us holy through his commandments and commands to light the Chanukah light. The Gemara asks, and where did he command us? Meaning, this God didn't command us, the rabbis. The mitzvah of Chanukah is not mentioned in the Torah. So how is it possible to say it was commanded by God? The Gemara answers, Rav said, the obligation to recite this is blessed. This blessing is derived from the verse, you shall not turn aside from the sentence that they declare to you to the right or to the left. From the verse we just saw in the previous source. Those rabbis, that Sanhedrin in Jerusalem, who gave the restrictions, also gave us 7 mitzvos as well. So now, I know we did that list at the beginning, but if you just flip back for a second on that last page, this is really number 4 and 5. Gezeros to Rabbanon is when they tell you not to do something. These are the categories right on the 2 Torahs. The rabbis tell us not to do something, not to carry a shofar, not to carry a Megillah for Purim if it falls out on Shabbos, not to carry a Lulav and Esrog when it falls out on Shabbos. And they also gave us Tikkunos. They gave us all these brachos about before eating, getting benefit from food, by lighting Shabbos on Friday afternoon, Chanukah, Purim, washing our hands, right? Hallel, we have a lot of brachos. These are all things that the rabbis came along and gave us to do as well. Now you say, okay, but they don't know me. The rabbis don't know me. They don't know my struggles, my ins and outs, what I'm capable of doing, what I'm not capable of doing. So it comes on the Gemara in source number 6. Shein gozer and gezeir al tzibur. They don't make a decree upon the public, unless the majority of the people are able to keep this. If the majority of people can keep it, doesn't mean everybody, but if the majority of people could keep this restriction, then it stands. But if the majority of people couldn't do that, they would see, look, we made something, we just see, you know, the majority of people can't do it, so they would repeal it. Not every rabbinic fence that was set up was maintained. Sometimes they would go back in and say, this isn't, it's not feasible, it doesn't work.
Is that where the Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin comes in?
Or? The Rabbeinu Tam's a little bit different. Rabbeinu Tam had an argument with his grandfather, Rashi, as to what is the order of the 4 sections of the Tefillin, what order to put the 4 in. So Rabbeinu Tam had a different version. With the Halacha follows Rashi. That's done. Anybody puts on tefillin, we do Rashi, we make a bracha on Rashi's order of tefillin. Rabbeinu Tam had an argument. So a person wants to be strict upon themselves and take upon something that's not necessarily required. They could put on a second set of tefillin afterwards. They wouldn't make a bracha on it, but they would still put on a second pair to satisfy the opinion of the Rabbeinu Tam. Hmm.
Yeah. But I wonder why his opinion in this particular case is considered a chumrah when other opinions are not valued at all if they weren't the majority or if they weren't.
Yeah, so that's a good. You're asking an excellent question. When does the halacha take into account rejected opinions, and when doesn't it? So the Vilna Gaon, I believe, was quoted as saying, if you're going to be concerned about the Rebbeinu Tam's opinion, is what the order is. I think he said, if I'm correct, there's 24 different opinions you have to be concerned for. So therefore, I'm not concerned about any of them. I'm only concerned about the one that we actually follow, and I don't take on this. Some people in general have a tradition they like to try to cover their bases and like to try to get as many opinions in. You don't have to. You're certainly not required to.
Right. And so I wonder, when is there a clash between building a fence and putting a stumbling block before?
So that's the whole point. That's right here.
Right.
It's a stumbling block when the majority of people can't.
Right.
It's a fence when the majority of people can.
Right.
Yeah.
So then if you're taking it on your own accord, and as a chumrah, I feel like that's still negating the rabbi's decision.
Why?
Because
I'm saying I'm not required to do this. I'm just going to go beyond the letter of the law. But a person shouldn't really take on chumras on their own unless they have, again, like I said, somebody who knows them well and can what's realistic and what's not. Sometimes chumra means something that's stringency beyond the letter of the law. Sometimes you find young men and women who basically on their own decide what level they're at. And they come up with these crazy, ridiculous things that really don't have any source or not on the level that they're currently at or not.
You're setting yourself up for failure sometimes.
Yeah. That's why you have to have a Rebbe. You have to have someone who knows you and can guide you and tell you this is appropriate right now. This is. If someone's having a difficulty, struggling with keeping kosher, so they're not going to say you have to be strict and only keep Chol Yisrael.
Yeah.
Right? So that Chol Yisrael, I'll actually just use an example. So let me cover one more source and I'll come back to give an example of what this means. Okay, there's a Gemara here. I'm going to do just quickly outside. We don't give the reasons at first for why the rabbis made these rules, because a person would think, oh, that reason's not going to apply to me. If you tell me the reason or something, like, I don't tell my kid. The answer is no. Why not? I don't have to tell you why not. I just say no. But I tell my kid, why not? Because then they'll come up with, but what about this? What about that? So we don't tell reasons at first. Look at number 8. Rabbi Yitzchak said, for what reason were the rationals of the Torah commandments not revealed? It's because of the rationals of two verses were revealed. They told us the reason for two of them, and the greatest in the world, King Solomon, failed. So we know for a king, there are prohibitions, restrictions about what a king is allowed to do. He's not allowed to have too many wives, and he's not allowed to have too many horses. And the Torah tells you the reason why. For the wives, it says that they might lead you astray. So King Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech, said, no problem, I'm the wisest person in the world. I'll just pick my wives carefully, I'll take more than I'm allowed to, but I'll make sure they don't mess me over, lead me astray, get me to worship idols, influence me in a negative way. So when you have the wisest man in the world who thinks he can outsmart the Torah, he says, look, so I'm going to read the English now. He shall not add many wives for himself, his heart should not turn away. Solomon said, I'll add many, but I won't turn away. Right? And he thought it's pretty to have many wives if he's otherwise meticulous not to stray. And later on it's written in the book of Kings, it came to pass when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods. He failed. We believe that people are human. They're not infallible. Shlomo HaMelech, the wise of all men. So Torah revealed, what's the reason? Why can't you have too many wives? The reason why you can't have too many wives is because you'll go astray. So if the Torah hadn't given the reason for that, then maybe they would have changed things. That's in the Torah itself. When the rabbis made a rule, they would tell the reason behind the rule after 12 months. Trial run. Here's the rule, and we're not going to tell you why. And then if they see that people can keep it, then they would reveal the reason behind it. If you look, that's the source number 9, it's Gemara in the Avodah Zarah. Ula said, when the sages decreed in the West, this is written in what's Bavel, which is modern day Iraq. So in Iraq, they're turning to the West, that's referring to the land of Israel, right? They wouldn't reveal the reason behind until 12 months that had passed, lest there be a person who doesn't agree with it and will come to treat it with contempt. You tell me the reason why you can't carry a shofar is because you might come to carry. No problem. I'm just going to put it in the shul before Friday. No one will worry about it. And I'll circumvent the rules. I'm not going to take the rabbinic laws seriously. So they wouldn't reveal the reason for the first 12 months. And then once they saw that we saw it a minute ago that it's something that everybody could keep, then they would do it. Let me give you an example. Now we'll talk about the Chol Yisrael. Chol Yisrael means Jewish milk. According to the law, wherever you live, you have to make sure that what you're actually drinking is real milk from a kosher animal, and it's not camel milk, it's not pig milk, it's not etc. So the way that if it's supervised, the milking process, that's called Chol Yisrael. Jewish milk, because a Jew was watching, observing to make sure this is the real deal and it's not a substitute. That is the halacha, and that is what's required. You must drink Chalav Yisrael. However, there's a leniency. A leniency was given by one of the great deciders of Jewish law, Rav Moshe Feinstein. Zatzal passed away in the 1980s. And Rav Moshe Feinstein, although he himself was careful to only drink Chalav Yisrael milk, personally, he gave a ruling in America that we can rely upon government supervision. That's sufficient. And therefore, you could drink milk in America, even if it's not Chalav Yisrael, because government supervision, there's such heavy fines and penalties, and no company would jeopardize its existence by putting in non-kosher milk. It wouldn't matter. So therefore, that's why a person can go ahead and enjoy a good Hershey bar, which is not Chalav Yisrael, but you can eat the milk products that are not Chalav Yisrael. But they make good Chalav Yisrael candy bars also, so no one loses in the end. But that's an example of something that the people could keep. And they didn't give the reason. They said, we're going to have Chalav Yisrael. There's a second category of something called Pas Yisrael, Jewish bread. Bread only baked by a Jew. That was another thing the Jewish people could have that. There was a third category of a type of stringency they tried to introduce, but it was too difficult. It was too difficult, and so they repealed it. Could you imagine what food would be too difficult to go without? We got the milk, we got the bread.
Chocolate?
Shemen, oil. They tried to make an original thing, it was too much, and so they couldn't, they realized they can't keep this, and they repealed that one. So there's no, even nowadays, you people are strict on all sorts of things. No one's machpid to only have Shemen Yisrael. It's not there.
If something is inherently wrong, why are a group of people deciding that it's too much for somebody to keep?
Good question. Wait, if something is inherently wrong, the rabbis made a fence. So really, by technically speaking, from a Torah perspective, you're allowed to have this. The rabbis came in and added something onto it because they felt that this was something, for whatever reason, psychologically, people needed to have this. If they saw that people couldn't really do this, so then they'll pull it back and say, this isn't something that people can keep.
So there was technically okay, but the fence that they were...
But the fence creates a prohibition. That's why it becomes a little bit of a deep analysis level. Is the prohibition centered on the person, or is the prohibition centered on the object? What am I talking about? Let me break this down for a second. On a Torah level, the only thing that's permitted to not have is beef and milk. But chicken and milk, on a Torah level, is allowed. The rabbis came along and said, no, we can't have this. Because if we allow people to technically have chicken and milk, it's okay. So 1 week they'll eat the chicken milk, they'll put a slice of cheese on the chicken sandwich, they'll have some cream of chicken soup. But you know what? It's going to come 3 weeks from now, 2 years from now, and they're going to run out of chicken and say, you know what? I forgot, but they'll just put a little beef in because the chicken, it's so easy. By the way, I'm telling you, this is not a far-fetched thing. I get questions like this very frequently from people who have like kashrus mix-ups with stuff like this. So don't think this is like something, oh my God, that'll never happen. I'm telling you, it happens every day. It happens every day, people, when we get mixed up. So the rabbis came along and said, you can't have chicken and milk. It's a rabbinic level. So exactly, well, isn't that, if it's inherently wrong, why? The answer is, it wasn't inherently wrong. On a Torah level, chicken and milk is allowed. On a rabbinic level, chicken and milk is forbidden. So we keep rabbinic Judaism. That's the whole, we started off by pointing out. The Torah says, we follow what the rabbis tell us. So now, here's the nitpicking, here's the hair slicing. When the rabbis came along and said that the chicken and milk is prohibited, what's the correct way in analysis? Is that I personally cannot eat chicken and milk, but the object itself is really fine, or no? When the rabbis came and said that chicken is milk, they zapped it, they created something, a prohibited status on the object itself. Do rabbinic laws focus on the person, that you yourself can now not long eat meat, chicken and milk, or no, that the chicken and milk inherently became converted to something that's prohibited? That's a little of a razzle-dazzle analysis that's what they learn in yeshivas all day. They go back and forth trying to figure out what's the correct answer to that question. At the end of the day, we're not going to do it, so it doesn't really matter for our discussion as to what it is. But the answer is that it wasn't inherently prohibited on a Torah level, but once the rabbis came along, then it is prohibited. Yeah.
So isn't part of, if you've done your due diligence, it is on you, because it's like you have checked to make sure that, like, you know, it's maybe it's not Halav Israel, but it's got the, USDA or whatever stamp on it. And so you've done your due diligence that says cow milk. I believe it's cow milk because it's got the stamp. And even if you later find, you drank it or whatever, and you later find out that, oh no, it was horse milk,
right,
you didn't commit an avera because
you did your due diligence. You did your due diligence, correct.
And so it's not the substance itself that was inherently, like, going to cause a you know, you did sin. It was, it's more in the
it's an excellent question you're raising. That would depend upon this analysis of whether the prohibition is on the person or the prohibition is on the object.
Right.
Right?
Like, is there, I've heard this argue about non-kosher meat. Like, is it inherently there's something wrong with it, or is it just the fact that we give it a task, and the mitzvah is in doing that task, not in necessarily that there's nothing wrong about, you know, meat that's not kosher or something that's, you know, I've heard both.
Right.
Arguments,
right. But it's a famous discussion. I didn't make this up tonight.
Right. Yeah. There is putting in your, you know, good college effort into making sure that you've done the right thing, and if it turns out that,
right,
you know, you didn't, I don't...
Now, let me take your question a step further. What happens if I ask my rabbi for a ruling, and the rabbi got it wrong, but I follow them? Rabbi, am I allowed to do this on Shabbos? And he says, yes. So I go ahead and do it, and he calls me up Sunday morning, says, you know what? Oops. I forgot, I got confused, I understand. So if I acted upon a reliable, again, there's lots of people who use the title who are not qualified, but if I asked on a reliable authority in Jewish law and they told me what to do, it's not on me. I did my due diligence. That's why it's nervous whenever you're answering a question, because the axe is on your neck. But okay. All right, so we have a few minutes. Let me try to get a few more points in. We're not going to get everything, but hopefully enough to think about until we meet again. Number 10. The rule is that if something was set up by a Beis Din, by a court of Jewish law, the 71, it can only be repealed by a group that's greater than them in number and in wisdom. And for practical reasons, that doesn't happen. We can't repeal any of the laws right now because we're not greater than they were. The famous example they give of this, we keep a second day of Yom Tov. The original reason why the rabbis set up a second day of Yom Tov, 2 days of Pesach, 2 Siddurim, Sukkot, etc., is because back in the days when they used to have witnesses, an eyewitness would come and see the new moon, they would send out messengers to tell everybody when Rosh Chodesh, when the new month was. So they weren't sure yet when a month could either be 29 days, it could be 30 days. So if you lived in a community, they didn't know, they couldn't get the message, there was no WhatsApp back then. How are you going to get the message? So how do you get the message that the message had to come to you and tell you, well, yeah, well, last Thursday was Rosh Chodesh, so you count it, so now I know when to keep Pesach. Now I know when Sukkot is. But if the message couldn't be kept a second day out of a doubt, nowadays I can open up the Nassau calendar and I can tell you when Rosh Chodesh, when the new month is going to be for the next 100 years. There is no longer a doubt as to what exactly is the correct. But since the rabbis in the times of the Gemara made a rule of we keep 2 days of Yom Tov, that rule is on the books, because we don't have a greater authority to repeal it. So these are type of laws that even though reason doesn't apply anymore, we nevertheless observe and we keep it. I'm going to make a brach on the second night of Mashiach's going to come. We'll be in Yerushalayim. But if unfortunately Mashiach doesn't come this year, I'll make a bracha on the second night of Pesach also when I'm doing the mitzvos. We treat it as the exact same status, even though we know really when Yom Tov is, right? That's basically the summary of 11. 10, yeah. Let me go to the last thing for something. This is taken from a sefer that came out from Rav Herschel Schachter from Yeshiva University. He's quoting from his rabbi, it was Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik would frequently speak of this idea, meaning the importance of Pesach that's independent of personal biases. Pesach means giving a ruling in Jewish law. And his writings emphasize that the Mesorah, which we talk about tonight, the transmission of the Torah from generation to generation, is not just the transmission of the halachos, but the transmission of attitudes as well. In this context, he spoke of the Rebbe-Talmud relationship. The Talmud, the student, must absorb much of his Rebbe's personality as well, because the attitudes also have to be transmitted. This notion appears in the Talmud regarding the concept of an Am Haaretz. In contemporary usage, an Am Haaretz is an ignoramus. A person doesn't know how to learn Torah. However, the Talmud uses the term differently. In some contexts, it means one who's insufficiently observant. Elsewhere, however, the Talmud records an opinion that Am Haaretz, one who has Korav Hashana, who's learned scripture in the Mishnah, nonetheless, he's lacking because he's not engaged in Shimush Talmidei Chachamim. He hasn't studied at the feet of rabbinic scholars. Apparently, one who's acquired a broad knowledge of all the relevant texts but hasn't absorbed the attitudes of Talmidei Chachamim through personal interactions is considered an Am Haaretz. Rabbi Soloveitchik would sometimes use this expression to criticize the actions of younger rabbis who, despite personal scholarship, displayed insufficient sensitivity to the attitudes of the tradition. Thus, it's required of a Talmud Chacham that he internalize the attitudes of the Torah, that his interpretations of the Torah represent that internalization, rather than his personal preferences or beliefs imposed upon the Torah. Indeed, the Talmud says that one who accuses the Chacham of ruling based on their personal history or biases deserves to be excommunicated. So we have very strong this. We assume that when you ask a rabbi for a question, it's not their own personal biases. They're giving you the answer based upon a thorough understanding of the sources and from the attitudes and the we use as the hashkafa, the thought processes of their teachers which they received. I had the privilege to learn under many, many great rabbinic teachers. I learned from their attitudes. I learned from their casual conversations. I learned from walking down the street with them and seeing the way they interacted with other people. There's certain things that you can't get from books, right? We know that. You can get any degrees you want online. You can't get a smicha online. You have to be in it. You have to understand and experience it. There's something about Judaism that just, you can't give over from the books. You can never convey through a book that the smell of the chicken soup or the glow of the candles on a Friday night. These are things that we've absorbed through the culture. It makes us who we are. It's what we breathe. This is like we say, it's in our kishkas. This is who we are. And this is all part of our Masorah. So unfortunately, we're out of time, so I didn't get a chance to answer all the questions tonight. But Ricky will follow up. You let me know if there's any questions or things to direct, and you'll give me a topic for next time.
Absolutely.
Okay. Have a great evening, everybody.